All right. I think we can get going. Good morning, everyone. It's a shame this is the last day. I don't know about you. I could keep going, but it is unfortunately the last day and the last panel, and it's quite a short day too. So we have a panel on peace tech, as you know, after which we will meet in the castle courtyard for our closing segment. So we've prepared a jazz brunch for you this year. We'll enjoy the beautiful backdrop of the castle courtyard as our workshop and panel moderators draw conclusions, highlight key findings, and summarize their sessions with us. So this is really your chance to find out what happened in all the other rooms that you weren't in, and what were the conclusions of the workshops, the panels that you didn't participate in. We end at 12:30, at which point everyone who is booked on the transfer back to Vienna at 1 p.m., will please find their luggage and make your way to the transfer. The transfer will be leaving at 1 a.m. sharp, whether you are on it or not, but we would much prefer to have you on it, so please be on time. But first, get ready for the last deep dive of the year's conference as we discuss how we can best use technology for peace in times of the climate crisis. Guiding you through your panel will be your moderator, whom I assume you all know, and also Senior Project Manager for Peace Tech here at the Austrian Center for Peace, Nathan Coy.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best part of the conference. Well done. Good gemacht. As I said, for me to introduce me as Nathan Coyle, and I am the Senior Project Manager for Peace Tech here at the Austrian Center for Peace. Welcome to our panel called Technology for Peace in Times of Climate Change, in fact. So we'll be talking about how we can use data and social tech for social good, and how we can empower peace builders to use technology and data for peace building, especially for environmental purposes. I am very, 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 very blessed and lucky to have an amazing panel with me today, who I am going to invite to introduce themselves. So please, Sara, if you'd like to start.
Yeah, actually. Sure. So I'm Sara Petti. I'm the International Network Lead at Open Knowledge Foundation. Open Knowledge Foundation is basically a nonprofit that builds open source infrastructure to help people use data better in order to unlock information and produce positive social change. Yeah, I'm based in Bologna, Italy, and I've been always interested in questions around access to information. Fabiola.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Fabiola Hanna. I am an artist scholar. I have been building oral history archives in order to think about historical justice in different contexts, especially in Lebanon. And I'm also writing a book about digital dialogue and how to get to historical justice through this kind of work and dialogue projects in general. I'm an assistant professor at the New School, so I'm based in New York.
Hello, everyone. Delighted to be here in front of all of you. I'm Paulina Behluli, originally from Kosovo, an open data activist in Kosovo, currently based in Berlin, working as a program manager for the Data Tank, a non-for-profit think tank focused on data reuse for the common good. So we're not directly specialized on data for peace, but peace definitely falls within the common good spectrum.
And hello, everyone. My name is Fabian Lasci. I work for the United Nations Development Programme, the Crisis Bureau, which is based in New York, but I'm based and serving from the beautiful Vienna in order to serve the countries that are facing crisis around the globe. A very convenient time zone, that is the main reason why. And I do digital assessments, analysis using various technologies that some of them I'm going to also to explain, basically using data for crisis preparedness, crisis response, and build back better and development.
Thank you so much. And I also must say as well, we're recording this episode for the Peace Tech podcast, which we have on Spotify. So please no booing, because that'll be on the podcast. So, okay, guys. So, climate change impacts conflict, acting as an obvious risk multiplier. Environmental peacebuilding mitigates these risks and seeks opportunities in areas like water supply, migration. But how can we make environmental peacebuilding data more user-friendly for those on the ground? And Fabian, I'd like to start with you, if that's okay.
Thank you. Well, I'm happy, and hopefully I'll not be very long into the UN language. I'm trying to make it very pragmatic and what we are doing in this direction, let's say. First, let me just introduce and give you a bit of what is in our crisis offer. We are trying to have data and analysis before the crisis through the anticipate and prevent. During something happens and immediately after that happens through the early recovery, which we call respond and recover. And then there is this other group of countries where we categorize as fragile and protracted, those crises that are lasting for a long time. For each of these blocks, we use data and technology in order to make sure that sometimes we prepare or anticipate certain sudden events, because as we say in UN, and I'm pretty sure you are aware, there are no the natural disasters, but rather are hazards and are man-made disasters because of poor quality of building, lack of information and preparedness, no early warning systems to make sure that people are aware what is going to happen in the short period of time, such as floods or the drought that is now present in a lot of geographies. And as I mentioned, we are using different technologies for achieving this. One of the most interesting that I wanted to share with you is the NDVI, the Normalized Difference Vegetation Index, we call. Just by looking to the satellite imagery before and after in different cohorts and periods, we are trying to understand how development is in a way impacted from the climate change. Because vegetation is a pure, indicator about prolonged droughts or floods or other events that might happen in different geographies. And in a lot of countries, including here Africa, but also Latin America and Southeast Asia, might be the only income for the families or the main one. So we're trying to understand not only this satellite imagery fiction science type of a thing, but rather trying to understand the multidimensional vulnerability, because as we believe that through the data that we collect on the household level, sometimes very granular, but also at the community and livelihood level, it's important to understand how livelihood assets, how economies of the families, individuals, are impacted not only from the income, which is the main dimension converted, let's say, in GDP and in other economic parameters where the poverty is measured, but there are a lot of other dimensions that should be factored in, and data helps in this case, including here access to education, access to health, mortality of children in, under five, for example, malnutrition, which is another thing that is in our mandate as UN, and other parameters. So I maybe just give you very quick three examples. We work, for example, in Colombia in order to support the peace building alongside the and together with United Nations Environment Programming, or UNEP as it is well known, to build this local organization capacity in conflict-affected areas. This initiative aimed to address this environmental challenge and to promote peace. Of course, data and systems are a very important part of it. In Sudan, again, a peace-building facility project that we implemented with UNICEF this time, and we addressed water scarcity and contributed to elevating this communal inter-tribal tension as lack of resources now are accentuated in a lot of geographies. And last, and then ending my intervention, is the Sahel region, where we have different initiatives, but one that is very much related with the climate, change, is the Youth Eco Bridge focuses on livelihoods to conflict prevention in cross-border areas between the Nigeria, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Over to you, Nathan.
That's really fantastic, and it's always nice to hear different examples because that means other people can be influenced by them, or in my case, steal them. Paulina.
Yes, thank you, Nathan. So I'm not going to draw so much examples, except for one that we did with the data tank, with the project that we're having. But I'm going to draw more concepts on what we're developing as a research also think tank. So in order to really make the data more friendly for those on the ground, we have to also tailor the language that people working on the ground will understand. So just presenting raw data in their raw format, it's not really digestible, especially for people that are focused in different professions and different work in different environments. And a reflection that I had here during the conference as well is that we're all operating in silos, really. Whether we're working in the environmental field, whether we're working for whether we're working in other industries like the data, tech, we're really operating in silos. And this is a very big concern because we're constantly developing new technologies, new methodologies, but we're not communicating with each other. So that is a big problem that then creates this gap or this divide between different sectors, between different industries. So a way to address this and to also include those on the ground is by setting up data collaboratives. So with the data tank, our co-founder has helped establish this data collaborative for children. So together with UNICEF, and the University of Edinburgh. And what the idea behind the data collaborative is that people from different backgrounds, so you have one policy activist, there's another data professional, like a data scientist, there's another researcher who specializes in research, and then there's policymakers from the government, policymakers either from the local level, so bridging this gap between these existing silos and bringing together in the same table different views and different opinions that, of course, focus on one thematic area, on one thematic focus. And one could be setting up a data collaborative for climate resilience or for climate change. And setting up this data collaborative would initially take some resources, of course, but in the end, I think the benefit, the return on the initial investment would definitely be extremely high. And in these these data collaborative systems, then you would also include peace builders, but also include people or teams that are working exactly on the ground who report their data that they're directly collecting from the ground. And then you already have the policymakers involved there who can bridge this gap by addressing it into policy, by addressing the data into policy. And this way, you can create a common language between a multidisciplinary group. You can influence more these setups, these systems, and eventually, of course, we're not going to solve the world issues of climate change, but we're going to impact into, like, it's going to be a good step towards fixing it.
Yeah, that's, I just want to kind of fully agree with you there, especially silo working. And as we know, especially people from big organizations, it's not just people who work in different departments, sometimes they're in the same department. And data is really bad at this, especially open data. As you know, when I was doing the research for my book, one of the big issues of why third sector wasn't using more open data was this siloed working, and especially people who are in, let's say, positions of power and their interpretation of what the data is, and then pouring that down into their teams and the problem and the narrative gets muddied. And so that is a real massive barrier for why peace builders don't use open data, especially for environmental peace building, because they feel like it's not for them. So excellent, excellent points. Thank you, Paulina.
Yeah, that brings also who owns this data, and we, as we all know, data is power. So if we're working towards people self-advocating, community organizing, then it is truly important for whoever has any data to share to follow some general principles about sharing these in a way that are accessible and available to people. So there's a 2016 paper on data stewardship and management, and they've outlined four basic principles called the FAIR principles: findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. So make the data findable so that people can, if they are looking for some kind of data to advocate, then let it be available. Accessible in multiple formats, and interoperable, thinking about how it could be carried over in multiple ways, and reusable in the sense that if it is if a certain data set is used for a particular project, and it might be transferable to another kind of advocating purpose, then that data can be reused. But it's always a question about how this data is then used. So how is it collected? How is it preserved? So if we're always focusing on what kind of data is needed and when and how, so let it always match what people need it for. So if it needs to be translated, let that be translatable. If it needs to be mapped, then let it be mappable. With regards to also the ethics of figuring out how to make data accessible and all that, it's really important to also think about how this data is collected and whether people have consented on it, if they are involved from the beginning with that kind of access. Yeah.
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Fabio, for making some very, very important points. I'm going to come back later to the quality of data, which is super important. But the first point that I would like to make is around access to data, which is still a big problem in the sense that you still have many countries in which you don't have, for example, central data portals. Statistics are outdated. Research is paywalled. So maybe something that we should start thinking is also like when we publish data, how is the data distributed? Where is it published? Can people find this data? Can they reuse it? And now coming exactly to the FAIR principles that you were talking about, it's maybe worth thinking about making the data open, so reusable and remixable by people, but also open doesn't always mean that the data is FAIR, and those are not synonyms. So, of course, those are two things that people need to take into account. One other thing that I maybe want to mention is at the moment at the Open Knowledge Foundation, we are developing an application called Open Data Editor, which basically allows people with non-technical skills to validate their data and sort of like spot mistakes and correct them. And we did a big user research around it. And the interesting point in a way was that while technology has moved super fast in the last 20, 30 years at the speed of light, when you come to the problems that people work with data face, they are exactly the same that were there since the beginning of tabulation, which is basically data is still very messy, is poorly structured, people don't know how to find it, it's badly archived, and all these kind of problems. So to make it useful, again, the quality is super, super important. So fairness of the data, but also like using, I would advocate for open standards, but at least standards of some kind. And also like give people the opportunity to use ready-make and very easy tools like this Open Data Editor that we are developing. And one other thing that we kind of like understood through this user research, going also to the points that I think Fabian, but also Paulina made, is around the language of tech tools and the fact that sometimes you have very difficult language, and this is a barrier. It was something that was mentioned in the workshop on Tuesday as well, where basically if the language is too complicated or too technical, then people will just assume that this is not for them. And when we were sort of like researching the language around this tool, for example, at Open Knowledge Foundation, we generally speak with very technical people, very expert, and there were some terminology that we use that we just assume that everyone understands, like validating data. And I'm sure that the UN has this same kind of jargon as well that you use, assuming that everyone will understand, but actually it's not. So it's sometimes good to also take a step back from the assumption and questioning also what is there. And translation, of course, would be also super, super useful. And then maybe just the last point very quickly, as we talked on Tuesday about also the difficulty linked to the overwhelming quantity of data that is available. And I would argue also that there is an overwhelming complexity around technology. And this is something that at the Open Knowledge Foundation we really want to tackle. So from October, we're launching this campaign called The Tech We Want, which is basically saying how can we make tech less complicated. There are all these layers that are not really needed and that people have to adopt because this is just how it is. So how can we reclaim tech and make it more fit to our needs?
Thank you so much. Does everyone know what open data is? Some of you do. So just for the people who don't, it's how we open data is how we can use data that's free and open, replicate free of charge. Open data is actually name of the license, not actually the data sets. So most cities around the world and governments will have an open data portal. So when we're talking about using open data for social good and environmental peace building, it's using that data that's out there already. And a bit later on, we've come onto trust, because there's a real issue with trust when it comes to open data. And if we have time for questions, I'm sure one of you is going to ask us, so it's great to have all this data out there, but how can we trust it? But we will cover that a little bit later.
And here comes another example of assumption, you know, me assuming that everyone understands what open data is. So.
Yeah. And again, so, you know, one of the issues is I have a lot of conversations about is this narrative of what open data is and the different perceptions of what open data is. And from my experience, the big issue with open data not being used more is language. It's that simple. It's not because it's overcomplicated. Because when you really deep dive into it, open data is just a PDF or an Excel sheet or whatever. It isn't that complicated, and it can be a really powerful mechanism for social change. Everything from funding to campaigning. There are lots of uses to open data. Anyway, I'm rambling, I'm sorry. So guys, the digital divide affects conflict zones massively. And let's face it, every zone in the world, post-conflict to every community under the sun. But how can we empower people to use digital tools for environmental peace building, especially low-tech solutions? And the reason why I wanted to really put forward this idea of low tech, because if you go to refugee camps or, you know, anywhere around the world where, you know, things are happening, you might be harder pressed to find people with laptops, and, you know, especially in camps. But you'll find mobile phones. It might be a smartphone, or it might be a Nokia 3210, which I still proudly have. And so, if you can have a conversation about these low-tech solutions, that'd be really interesting. But obviously go mad and tell me all about the high-tech stuff too. So I'm going to start with you, Saira, if that's okay.
Yep. So I think taking a step back, reflecting on this, one thing that we need to take into consideration is the fact that conflict zones, but not only conflict zones, also other zones in like developing countries as well, lack the infrastructure on one side to build the technology, meaning that they don't have the machinery to build it. And on the other side, they lack the infrastructure to make it function. So for example, there would be like power shortages, internet shutdowns, and all these kind of things. So I think it's really important when we think about also this low-tech solution is that we take into consideration that we need to have an online, offline approach. And I'm going to give an example. In the Open Knowledge Network that I lead, we have a chapter in Ghana and developed a very, very interesting project called the KeyWeeks Project, which is basically providing offline educational resources for senior high school in Ghana. And the project works very well, you know. And because we have this network and all the projects that we do are open source, so basically people can replicate it elsewhere, someone else from the network from South Sudan thought, okay, you know, I'll try to replicate this in South Sudan. But when they tried, actually, and they tried to implement it locally, they very quickly realized that it would not be as effective as in Ghana, for the simple reason that most students in South Sudan don't actually know how to use a computer. Actually, only 10% of the population is digital literacy. So digital literacy is definitely a very, very important component of this. We cannot build a solution if citizens don't understand how to use it. And then maybe a second point that I wanted to make is there's work to be done around incentives and really making people understand that using that tool or using that data, it's very useful for them. There are some very interesting projects in that, and maybe one that I want to mention that I heard actually last month at another conference is a project that was run by a group of civic tech in Nigeria. And the project is called Mapping Makoko. Makoko is an informal settlement in Lagos, which was completely out of the map. Nothing was mapped, and that meant that the place was basically not prepared for planning infrastructure or planning emergencies. And basically, through mobile phones that you just mentioned, some civic tech activists from Lagos worked with the local communities and with an international group of journalists to map the settlement on the ground, comparing it with satellite imaging, and then the journalists were building a story around it. And that worked because people then saw the importance of doing something like this and how it was useful for them.
It's amazing. It's really powerful. Gut gemacht.
Yeah, super exciting. So I think the common sense approach to this would be to always include people who are involved in the design process from the beginning, whether there is a need for it, how to do it, all through the implementation process and distribution, etc. For example, an example of what not to do is the project called One Laptop Per Child, or OLPC, that was funded to distribute kind of green laptops that were super stripped down. It had a hand crank to be powered. Millions of dollars went into it across so many years to be distributed globally in so many different places. And it was a complete failure because the people designing it were designing it for their younger selves rather than for the communities that would be using them. There's a recent book also on this that I highly recommend by Morgan Ames, if you're interested in that specific case study. So always involving people through each step of the process. Making sure, when we talk about conflict zones in different refugee camps, before we have water infrastructure or electricity, there are charging stations and connection to WhatsApp. Everyone, or a lot of people, prioritize a connection to being able to communicate, receive information, news, what's going on. So always thinking also about including mobile applications or phones or accessibility. And in thinking about accessibility, rather than having something from critical disability studies, for example, is to always, rather than think of making a project accessible to people with different abilities, including literacy, but also people using wheelchairs or needing visual information or audible information in different formats. So if you plan for that to begin with, rather than it being an afterthought, you're always going to be more accessible and serve so many different cases that are surprises than when if it's not left as a secondary or even last kind of access point. So thinking about that from the beginning is also a really good practice.
Perfect. So to continue on Fabiola's thoughts, another mode of engagement of citizens, of communities, of practice while you're designing in the very initial phase of designing solutions, it's also by setting up citizen assemblies. Citizen assemblies that bring together a group of community that could have, a thematic focus based on your target audience, who you want to intervene with, who you want to interact with, who the intervention is targeted to, and bring all of them together and brainstorm and start by asking the questions. So not by asking what available data we have or what type of data we have to collect, but really start by asking the questions on what do we need to solve, what is the problem at hand, and eventually end up with how data can help us solve that issue, and then dive into the data-driven questions into how do we collect that data? Where is the access? How do we ensure access to the data? So I think this mode of engagement of setting up citizen assemblies, it's also very helpful to make communities feel like they're also part of the designing process. And because in the end, these solutions are designed for us. Now I'm speaking in terms of my shoes as a citizen. They're should be designed for us. So why isn't my opinion taken into consideration when initially designing the solution? And by this way, you also at the same time, you increase data capacities, digital literacy also, it's increased because you're involving them in these topics, and you're starting also off with the questions that you need to address that then this data will help answer. And another program that we implemented, the Data Tank, it's called the Social License. And it's based on the idea of social license to operate. So, but it's an extended one. It's basically a framework on if we're using the data or if we're using, if we're collecting data from a specific community, how do we make sure that that specific community has rights to control that data, has autonomy over the data, and can also decide what the data is used but also reused with. This way you will also increase more awareness on this concept of self-digital determination. I don't know if you've been aware of, but it's all about having sovereignty, having power over your data. And this way, I think also by being able to control it, and in the initial phases, by being involved in the implementation, and by being involved in the design of the solution, in the end, in turn, I think it's one way of mitigating this digital divide. Of course, this only adds up to all the infrastructure that needs to be in place and all the extra training that needs to be in place, and thinking if you're going to come up with developing online courses, maybe you cannot go online in the beginning, but it has to be a hybrid model. You need a support person. So thinking of all the elements that, based on the community that are identified as community needs, because we have different community needs in different communities. So we cannot go with a simple agenda and conquer the world with that agenda. So we really have to take into advice specific needs.
Brilliant. So the takeout is human-centric design. And that's one of what you said, Fabi, as well. One of the big things I learn about is mistakes. So the things that didn't work, why didn't it work? I think they're more empowering than success stories sometimes. So great points, guys. Fabian?
Yeah, it's a good segue from what was mentioned before from Paulina. I would just want to bring a couple of stories. First one is when in 2020, we received a call knowing about a blast that happened in the port in Beirut. And it was COVID-19. All the curfew and nobody could go and collect data. The job that basically I do, I go with enumerators, with people, and do the damage assessment, look into the infrastructure, being this community infrastructure or private infrastructure, meaning apartments, households, and so on. So we had to come up with some innovative approach, and we did the very first crowdsourcing type of assessment, giving the possibility and the tools through Facebook, where people basically were reporting in an unstructured way the damages and the experience they were having, and rather giving us the possibility to ask questions through the messenger and to have in a structured way surveys. In this way, we collected in a week more than 3,000 reports for the apartments, their damages. We did the bill of quantities. We understood their needs and started addressing them through the humanitarian and other approaches and mechanisms also with the government in Lebanon. And when I was deployed, I already had the data to work with. So when I went in Beirut, basically I remember that we had enough evidence and information, and we started doing only the quality control and validating this data in the field. So this is one of the cases, but more and more we are now having as a practice to involve local communities, specifically young people, in the civil engineering schools, senior level at of studies, to do the assessments for us, with us. So we not only have volunteers, people that we are paying very little money when compared with companies that can run such assessment in the field, but we have what is more important than the money is that we have testimonies. We have members of the community interviewing their peers, their neighbors, their families. In this way, they are now in a roster that when similar events happen in Philippines, for example, we don't have to recruit anymore enumerators, people that run the survey. We just activate those that are already in the roster. So creating a more sustainable approach, if you like. And from the other side, there are civil engineers. They will be the future engineers. They will build back better. By assessing the failure of the infrastructure, of the buildings, they will understand, and now are understanding, that climate change and disasters that are happening need better infrastructure, need better building codes, and better engineering, application of their theoretical knowledge that they have and put in practice in the future. So in terms of future sustainability, this is quite an avenue. Another example I want to bring is how we distributed, in some of the cases, cash for work and cash for food. In a lot of countries, we have this challenge that we have to travel with money. But there are insurgents, there are conflicts going on, there are people very interested to get this money. And there are, our colleagues risk their life. So what we did, by introducing this e-payment or e-vouchers, we now distribute money digitally and cannot be more low-tech because people don't have to have an iPhone or a smartphone or to have any electronic tool with them. They just go in the center and present themselves either with ID document or just by scanning the eye retina for identification or the fingerprint. This is enough for them to access immediately the digital voucher, we say, that in most of the cases when it's cash for food, they just get the food they need for the amount allocated to them in their account. Or if it's cash for work, in these cases, they get credits in their account, let's say, just loading, demonstrating that they did the job, and this can be then later used for purchasing goods and services. So I'm just stopping here because of the time, as we have other very interesting examples. But over to you.
That's fascinating, especially about the e-vouchers and the e-currency. I'll be really interested to see how that progresses and the take up from my perspective, especially university researchers. Fabi, you'd be far more experienced in this than me. So when people go into the field, if you're going to place like South Sudan, for example, from my experience, my partner has to go to South Sudan a lot, and she has to take a lot of money with her, like thousands of dollars. And obviously that causes a lot of anxiety and stress for the researcher or the field worker. So it'd be really interesting to see how that pans out. And thank you for sharing that, mate. Really interesting. Okay, so we're talking about climate change and how brilliant tech is and what digital can offer us and what change it can make. But then you also have to juxtapose it because you have really energy-hungry data centers who are, you know, crunching all of this data for us to use, and you have mounds of e-waste. So my Nokia 3210, which I prize, other people don't prize it as much, so I'm sure there are loads of those about. But how can we balance the promoting of digital use for peace building with mitigating the environmental impact? And also, how do we ethically influence policymakers to kind of, you know, not just take this into account, but be more honest about, you know, the trade-off? So I'm going to start with Fabian, actually. That's okay.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Well, there are some good examples I wanted to share here from the private sector in the lead on taking care about the environment while there is an increased need for storing and processing large volume of data and information. I can start with Facebook that like 5 years ago built a big web farm, we call, like a very huge a space with big machines and mainframes that elaborate the data. And the north part of Europe, close to the fjords, where cold water all through the year is used for cooling down all the information systems and the infrastructure there, rather than having strong ventilators and air conditioning. They are built under the tunnels, meaning also benefiting from shade and also the temperatures that are low there. And all the environment on top of it is with solar panels, benefiting as much as it is possible with from the solar energy to contribute in and supplying with energy the machines. But is not the only one. Google did the same in at least last three big settings. Amazon is doing the same, and Apple, by excellence, has like a 100% eco-friendly environment in their last building that they implemented. So, of course, also from the policy-making perspective and what governments can do, can in a way follow similar practices. When building infrastructure, although some countries might be poor and not having all the means to create such a modern environment for having, this little footprint in the environment. But still, it's better to, develop maybe with a slower pace, but in a sustainable way, rather than just going for big machines and big architecture and ensuring that digital public infrastructure is there, but from the other side, creating a burden for the environment. I will stop here.
Thank you, Nathan. So, yeah, I would talk from two angles, so one from the policy side and one from the technical side, from hardware production. But from the policy side, of course, e-waste has to be integrated within all the climate targets, all the targets that different countries and governments are setting to reach zero carbon emission or to increase climate resilience. So in this regard, I think it should also, a lot of investment should be posed towards e-waste storages, where you can also invest in more recycling hardware tech. It goes in line with the policy awareness. And on the other side, if we're talking about hardware, we have to, now this is also a challenging process to align with corporations and manufacturers who are mass producing, for example, mobile phones, let's say a mobile device, to really think of the materials they're using and to really innovate their processes on what type of hardware selection can be reused for the other phone that you're going to produce, for example, and present this as a business model for the corporations, align with their views and say that this is a way where you can save your cost of production and you can also maximize the revenue in end. But also, alongside all of this, attach also the common narrative of common good and social good, and that corporations can, if they work for profit, you need profit to operate, and that's very understandable. Philanthropy is needed too. But of course, the way you distribute this profit and the way you contribute to the social good is a very important narrative that you have to attach it. Stop here.
I think thinking about the need back again, this is the common I think a place to start is always, if we need it, then let's build, then let's use it. Otherwise, let's just consume less. Especially in thinking about the rapid adoption of AI solutions, or what we're thinking of, large language models, and people jumping on the bandwagon of, okay, how can we use AI to make this decision better? It really caused a big stir, I think, in January or February of this year, when it was revealed that Microsoft was considering purchasing a nuclear plant in order to power these really energy-hungry processes, not only to just train a data set, so that's one kind of energy need, where you were talking about just to train the data set to begin with, will need something like thousands of... It's equivalent to the power that a thousand households or thousands of households in the U.S. on an annual basis, and households in the U.S. aren't necessarily efficient in any way. So thinking also about just the training of it and what it will cost, but then also the querying. There's millions of queries every single day to these ChatGPT, for example. I think coming back to thinking, what is the actual need? Is this going to be helpful before just jumping onto, yeah, let's use it, let's figure out how to use it. And I think another not to do thing to bring up is the case of carbon offsetting, where we're like, okay, let's just delay the solution. Let's misuse and use as much energy as needed, and then other people will figure it out, when we know it's just creating a different market for other kinds of futures that are also unnecessarily efficient. So I think the thing I'm saying is, actually, let's consume less data at this point.
No more mañana.
Well, I couldn't agree more with what Fabiola just said. I think that we really need like low-tech solutions with lower impact on the environment if we really want to tackle this for real. We should try to avoid complexity and duplication as much as possible. And in that sense, of course, the open source model offers a very good example of how much you can sort of like efficiently reuse and scale something without repeating an effort that is done elsewhere. But to go even more into what Fabiola just said, I just wanted to cite a very nice resource that I found a few months ago, which is called Don't Build It, by a scholar called Luke Jordan. And he's basically calling for a civic tech that is less tech and more civic. And what he says, he starts saying that the central problem of software is that anything can be built. And there was a very nice quote that I really want to read out aloud, which is, construct a monstrous building in the middle of nowhere and movies might be made about it. Build a pointless application that no one uses and you will just need to cite a misleading metric in a donor report and no one will care. And I think this is really something that we should focus on and really try to sort of like make it sink in, because we should definitely try to steer away from, well, the tech fetish that Fabiola was talking about. You know, now everyone is jumping on AI thinking that this will provide a solution. But actually technology will not resolve our problems. We should try to focus on more is how we can involve citizens more in the policies that affect them. And that was also to Paulina's point. So that's why also we're building this, the Tech We Want campaign at the Open Knowledge Foundation, thinking about how we can try to build less stuff maybe, and that could be actually a solution. And maybe one last thing that I would mention is, again, for the reusing part that Paulina was talking about, open hardware could also provide a promising solution in that sense, reusing material that is already there.
Really interesting. I really like the comment of more civic, less tech. That guy sounds like my spirit animal. I'd like to meet him. I just want to make a small point as well. So when it comes to, you know, how can we mitigate these two different areas, now I would look to what's worked in the past. So if you look at GDPR, which is the European Union's data compliance strategy, policy, and companies are terrified of GDPR, because ultimately, if they break GDPR, they will get fined massively. And I'm sure you've heard about Facebook getting fined 10%, was it? They didn't like that at all. Microsoft, all of the big organizations have been fined. And now, as we're coming into a different era with AI and the EU AI Act, I think that would be, again, as groundbreaking as GDPR because of, again, this comes out of the borders of the EU and massively affects the United States and Africa. So I would suggest just find them. Find them through the nose. But and then make all that money available to us amazing peace builders in this room, and we can do some good with it. So moving on, and then we have two questions left, guys. So with this next question, if you could be brief, because it would be really lovely if we can ask the last question. So narratives are crucial for encouraging digital use. What narratives, based on your experience, can activate people to use digital solutions for peace building? Now, I'm going to ask you to start, Fabi, so we have some different voices, and then we go to Paulina, and then Sarah, and then Fabian.
Okay. I think it would be, the idea that potentially we don't need to make things more open, or there might not be a need to encourage the use. So always starting with, do we actually need it? I think will be really key to thinking about it. But also the idea of openness. In a lot of cases, open data is crucial. But there are parts that might not necessarily be a good value, especially as people collecting their own data, finding ways to push back against history with a capital H. If we're looking to community archives and thinking about how to best represent people's stories, memories, which is a big part of peace building as well in thinking about ideas of belonging, etc. It's not necessarily appropriate to have it be open. So I think there's a lot of funding and grants that are now requiring as a condition for funding to make particular archives open, but this comes back to the issue of power. Who gets the say in saying who owns a particular data set and who doesn't? So keeping that an open question to begin with, I think, is key.
So yes, I'll try to make it short. Focus again on the human interest side, create user impact stories, start from a small neighborhood. You don't have to change the world to have a story. Start from a very small scale, and then you'll build up on it, and then other organizations will build up on it, and that will have the snowball effect for the better, for the common good. And also, while involving these communities, also explain on what can be done with this. And when you're innovating, when you're tailoring programs for innovation, do not throw so much money to innovate. Go to countries where innovation is born out of necessity, out of a last resource. That's why we innovate. When we're in stressful, in emergency situations, when we have no other resources, that's where when we innovate. Throwing bunch of funds for innovation and kind of like unnaturally forcing that will not really change the world. And innovation is really coming out of a last resort. And when we're talking about sustainability, when we're talking about climate friendly, we just have to think back in the days, how we acted back in the days, and maybe use the technologies that might help us construct these buildings, that use the materials that were used back in the days. So not really creating this future mindset, because this is what brought us here, clearly.
I just want a very, very brief point. Narrative is really important, and rhetoric is really important. So when you're building something, you should get your narrative correct at the first instance, because if you're going into innovation or building a tool, whatever, and then your narrative is broken, and then you come down the line, then you have to go back and fix it. So really want to echo that. That is really, really good learning. Get your narratives correct at the first instance. Sarah.
Yes. So if I have to think about narratives, for example, that worked for us, or reflecting on the work that we've done at the Open Knowledge Foundation, I'm thinking of mainly two projects that we worked on, which are actually now discontinued, I think. The first one is the Global Open Data Index, which is basically ranking countries based on a series of criteria on how they score in terms of like their open data policies. And another project is Open Spending, which was about building a platform to search and visualize basically data about fiscal data, basically, around countries around the globe. And I was trying to think, because those two projects really shaped the identity of the foundation in the sense that we're really perceived about, you know, I mean, being specialists in open data, open government, and like transparency. And I was thinking, how come, you know, that this shaped so much our identity, our network really still identifies with these two projects. And what I came to sort of like my conclusion, personal conclusion might not be true, but like what I think is that those projects were really projects of co-curation and collaboration. So the network people were the ones collecting all the data and inputting it in the platform, but then they were also using the platform as a tool to advocate for more open data and better open data with their local government. And I think this is really probably the core of it. If you have collaboration, basically you have shared ownership, and then people feel involved. And I think that that's the only way that you can activate people.
Yeah, I just want to bring also an example from the field. We have done in Lebanon what we call the tension monitoring using WhatsApp. So basically the communities and people that has access in WhatsApp, which is a very popular application across the globe, can report tension and certain incidents happening in their community. And in real time, we compute this data and create dashboards that inform local authorities, police stations, and I mean law enforcement units, but also upstream ministries and those in policy making, as well as UN entities, let's say. Through the dashboards and understanding where this narrative is being built and what is the implication with the news, fake news, and other information that we collect through social media, and triangulate all this information to understand the root causes, what triggered that reaction or in that specific incident, and as an early warning system, send this information to the authorities to intervene earlier rather than later, after the phenomena might be massive and a critical mass of people might be in the streets and so on. So this is quite an interesting real case and is running now as we speak, the tension monitoring tool. But also in case of Somalia, we have the Conflict Navigator, another similar tool that is rolling out as we speak, in order to understand federalism and the multiple entities governing the country there, and lack of resources as one of the root causes, specifically pasture and other, you know, livestock, let's say, challenges that the communities are facing there. So what works, based on my experience and our organization experience, is co-design with those that really need the solution. Both the solution are led, co-designed, and used on daily basis from those that benefit from the tool itself. You cannot send just something that is done here in Austria, for example, to Somalia. It worked here, might not work absolutely there. And a suggestion for this very prestigious forum, maybe next time we might have champions and group of innovators coming from Africa or Southeast Asia or Balkan countries, and together co-design a couple of solutions that maybe we can push to the implementation and send them back with something in their hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we can all agree with that, Matt. And yeah, co-design is so important, and everyone was vigorously nodding their heads, so well done. Final question, guys. Thank you so much for your time today. I want to talk about trust. So trust is a really big issue across the board, from using data to even adopting technology, even from a policymaker perspective as well, especially from government or big foundations when they're pushing down digital tools. It's just, why should we use this? You know, why and how can we trust this? So Reflecting on your own journeys, if you can, what best practices have you seen or implemented that have successfully built trust and encouraged digital technology to use in environmental peace building or social activism? Because I do think there are similarities there. And I'd like to start with Paulina and then go to Sarah and then Fabian and then Fabi, please.
Yeah, so now I'm going to go back to my work in Kosovo and the Western Balkans region. So what we did there to really try so we were a civil open data Kosovo, is the organization I worked at, where I also met Nathan. So back there, what we did is that we tailored these programs to collaborate with the public administration while always bringing citizens or youth or different groups, depending on the target of the project, in the discussion as well. Also, to build trust, it's one method, but then also you have to maintain trust. And I think maintaining trust might be even a more difficult mission than building it in the beginning. So you really have to think strategically when you're trying to build trust with the citizens or the user groups, whatever you're tailoring, whatever the program is. Then you really need to focus on what do you do after you build that trust and how do you maintain that trust? And that could be by making users' lives easier through developing these solutions, by making a change, and by communicating that change, and by really making people feel a part of that change, because it's not the creators of the solution that make the change, it's the users as well that are an incremental part of building it. And if your users are also your end beneficiaries, then I think that would create kind of like a win-win scenario by building trust and then trying to maintain it with developing solutions that are scalable and that are responsible and reliable for the sustainable use of it. So something that we've done in Kosovo, whenever we designed a portal or a digital solution, we were always thinking of how do we scale that further, be that through applying to other grants of extending the existing solution and not developing something completely new, or really focusing on how to maintain that even though the funding would end. So our mindset was the impact starts when the project finishes.
Really wonderful. Sarah, and we have 20 minutes left, just a little warning.
Okay. Well, a lot of things that Paulina just said resonate a lot with me. And I think that one answer maybe that could contribute to that is like civic tech. Civic tech meaning like the exchange between government and citizens and the co-creation of data. In the sense that it's not only citizens asking for governments to open the data, but it's really like them also co-creating, for example, building solutions to monitor what is happening, to give their opinion about what the government is doing. And last year at the Open Knowledge Foundation, we did very interesting exploratory roundtables around technology that were built, civic tech technology built around elections. And we found out, for example, some very interesting solutions that were born from the need, as Paulina said, like because there was a gap, and so this thing was built, and something very similar to what Fabian also mentioned before. So we found out, for example, about this election violence dashboard that was developed by the Africa Freedom of Information Initiative in Uganda. There was a very interesting promise tracker called Nzalendo from Kenya that I wish we could implement in Italy as well. And there's really a lot that you can learn from those initiatives. And the idea of trust is also around, I think, being able to use something that has been used elsewhere. And it's the whole idea of, you know, open source and open digital public infrastructure is this idea of having an open code that I can see and therefore I can trust. There is a community of contributors that kind of like makes sure that the decisions that are taken should make sense, at least in principle. The technology has already been tested somewhere, and I can directly maybe take it, scale it, adapt it to my local needs without having to start from scratch every time. So I really think that at the Open Knowledge Foundation, we're convinced that a technology that you can trust is actually a technology that is open by design. And maybe the last thing that I wanted to reinforce even more is, let's also not forget that technology is just a tool and it's not a solution. And it can help, but sometimes it can also add complexity and problems. So let's keep that in mind.
Mm. I always say that, I completely echo what you say, that digital is just a means to evidence stuff. You know, evidence the great work that you do. It's not the great work that you do, it's just to evidence it. But excellent, thank you. Fabian.
Yeah. In general, UN, in a lot of geographies, in a lot of countries we work, we have a good reputation and a certain trust in people. Because of, you know, our interventions and all our staff that is serving there, and maybe also because of the help that we are giving. But there are also other thoughts, other behaviors in other geographies, and there is also a bit of a narrative that is built lately, heard also in this panel, that might be something to reform, to change. UN is not the one, you know, giving the solutions. And a matter of trust is also widespread now across the globe. In our defense, I have to say that we, in a lot of geographies, for example, just to bring one, when Taliban took over in Afghanistan, we were the only agencies that stay and deliver. We were there, our people risked their life. And what is happening now in Gaza, we have, you know, hundreds of our colleagues that lost their lives in the field with the people. You can build trust by showing not only empathy, but you can build trust being there with them and deliver with them. So this is, I think, nobody can neglect. And of course, we might need reforms and we might need changes, and as every living organism needs to adapt to new realities. But what we're doing, I think, is quite a meaningful mission out there. In terms of digital arenas, well, as I mentioned, should be a benefit-based type of model. If people see benefits in the digital solutions that you give, trust is there. And if you, in a way, help to build this set of tools, such as data principles that we have, for example, or privacy and ethics guidelines, or other, you know, policy and processes that are that can be implemented by those that use the tools, not only at the user level but also as a supplier, being governments. Something that we're doing across the globe with our digital assessments initiative, and proposing exactly policy making and giving the tools in order to ensure a safer environment for use of digital tools, let's say, and systems, is something very concrete, because at the regulatory level, trust is built if it's shown that you have the means to manage it, as mentioned from Paulina, and to monitor it, and to also react when data leaks or bridges in the system, which are sometimes inevitable, are managed. How you react is very important to see if you are on top of things or it's just something, you know, that you really cannot handle it.
Really powerful. Thanks, man. Fabiola.
Yeah, I wanted to give an example of data that is more personal, because I feel a lot of times when we're thinking about data, it feels like it's a bunch of numbers, it's sensor data. Where are the issues there with trust? Going back to a project I did with oral histories, people, and what Paulina said about people trusting me, for example, with their own memories and stories and their lived experiences across their life. As I came back from a really intense period of interviewing, I sat down to process some of that data and did a quick experiment with thinking about, okay, there's this interview who the person became really agitated and was really sharing a difficult story, and I visualized that, thinking about this would be a really good representation of how memory sits also within the body, and after I put it and started just looking through it, I immediately stopped myself because I felt that if the person I interviewed would see this, I don't think he would appreciate it from his perspective. Although it might be representative, I don't think it would be something he would be okay with. So I just threw the whole part and came back to it. And I, even though I feel like it's had a particular purpose, it actually wouldn't be good for him. And I'm really happy with that decision about thinking what the person who trusted me with that data, in order to maintain that trust over the years, I think thinking about these or what people are consenting to give with their data, whether it's their environment or their own day-to-day life, I think it's really key to think of what would be okay with the people that this data is representing. We'll stop there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. That's the end of the panel for today. I want to thank Fabian, Paulina, Fabi, Sarah. You are all equally amazing human beings. You are rock stars. And was that a question? I thought you was putting your hand up. You're equally rock stars, and I really want to thank you for your time. And obviously, we're going to follow what you get up to, and we're going to stay in touch. Can I get a round of applause for our panel, please? And I'm going to pass you on to our lovely colleague, Dambita. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Nathan. Thank you to our speakers. It was a pleasure listening to you. Please make your way to the courtyard as we get ready for our closing event. There's coffee, there's Prosecco, kindly sponsored by Book Hotel Schleining. We're so excited you joined us, and...
Sorry, they're asking the
question. Oh, would you like to take some? I mean, we have 10 minutes.
Oh, don't worry, so. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Let's have some questions.
Excessively fantastically organized by me, but there we go. So just... I think we have a whole bunch.
Thank you very much, Irene Giner-Reichl from the ACP board. Thank you for this great panel. I've been working a lot on the nexus of energy and women's rights. And one of the problems that we encounter often is the non-availability of gender disaggregated data. Any comments from your side on this issue? Thank you.
Well, obviously that's a really prevalent issue because there's a lot of money around at the moment to make gender data more open. We'll see if that works, but there's obviously needs to be a reaction from the community. I don't know if you have experience from the UN.
Yeah, definitely. I think they can have some. Well, this is absolutely one of the problems that we recognize and we face on a daily basis. When we collect data, we definitely try to collect gender disaggregated data. But gender data goes far beyond beyond the frequency tables of that much women versus men, for example. It's not just a matter of quantitative methods. It's a matter of qualitative information that comes from in-depth and user stories, those that are primarily affected, and how women are dealing in crisis. How they are affected if they are part of a decision-making, either for the response or the early recovery or the reconstruction phase. Where to build, how to build, and does this creates all the facilities and necessary access for women to access such facilities created in the future. So these are absolutely central to our work. We are now refining also our assessment tools exactly to add this dimension. All those questions that I did are part of our new assessments that we're launching that is called the Gender in Crisis Assessments. I lead specifically this, and I'm proud to say that I think we can have much better data, and hopefully we are piloting now in July, mid-July, for the first time in Syria. And all the data that we are collecting, which is very important, are found in a couple of platforms, but the main one is called data.undp.org, where also gender disaggregated data around this dimension will be found there and are also available now as we speak. But we have also a platform for data, mentioning open data and access and so on, where after doing all the processes of minimization and anonymization and all the processes necessary for ethics and privacy, we publish in Data Partnership Platform, it's called DPP, which World Bank, UNICEF, and UNDP, WFP, a lot of entities, along with the private sector, such as Google, Microsoft, and other entities, Airstream from GIS, are part of this initiative. And proudly, I think you can find quite a lot of information also today about gender disaggregated information, yes.
So they can find all that. I also think there needs to be, so that's great from a UN perspective, but also there needs to be more pressure on other data givers. And, you know, and then we talk about this co-designed approach and we talk about the human-centric. I think there needs to be a bit of like a coalition between activism and policymakers, you know, and getting them to have a conversation. Of course, it's all well and good just releasing data, but then we also need to make sure that data is actually relevant, because it just wastes time for everybody. So, you know, I would like to see that going forward, more kind of pressure on those organisations. But it, like official pressure, because sometimes activism isn't enough. Sometimes building this wonderful open source tool isn't enough. There needs to be actual dialogue in official official areas, and hopefully maybe we can help facilitate that. Fantastic. Next question.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed your presentations, and I have a question. This is something that comes over and over again, especially in African countries, in sub-Saharan Africa, because I was involved in a project funded to help the Senegalese government design its national strategy on artificial intelligence. And there is a question that people always ask, because we know that in African countries, the IR, or technological ecosystem, is not very strong. And most of these countries rely on the technology, the infrastructure from the West in terms of storing data, but also getting the good data. And one of the questions is whether we are experiencing a new colony.
Interesting.
Where division of labor, where you have the infrastructure and we have labor. We can collect data, or we can provide digitized data. You use it to feed algorithms, to develop models that you will sell to the rest of the world. What would be your response to this argument?
I have a small point. So I was in Senegal very recently, and I was talking to some activists about open data, and it's all well and good talking about open data, but what if the data isn't there? And these activists were thinking about, well, are planning on setting up an open data Senegal. And it'd be really good to speak to you afterwards, because it'd be good to put you in touch with those people. But there needs to be some sort of responsibility from the Senegalese government as well. You know, there needs to be this buy-in, because like it's all well and good to say, well, data would be processed here or data would be held here. But they're going to use that data, right? So like, surely they have to take some responsibility in, you know, where data is housed and setting up own data infrastructure, even if it's just strategy, a roadmap towards that point. Now, talking about the open data in Senegal and talking about all these activists, now, these are actually a really powerful mechanism for making that happen, because with any government in the world, change won't happen unless there's a will or want for it. Now, that will or want needs to be evidenced, right? And how can you evidence that? It's by bringing communities together. And I know it sounds really flowery and a little bit woke, but that is how things happen. Like, if you look at especially what you guys do in the Open Knowledge Foundation, like, you've brought people together, you've activated people, that's actually influenced change on an international level. But there needs to be that will or want from the country. Now, it sounds like they have people like you, and you're working there and doing amazing work, so there is that will or want. but the activation needs to be on these community activists. And from my very, very simple experience of working in Senegal, where I met incredibly empowering, amazing human beings who do want that. And it would be really nice to speak to you afterwards, and I can put you in touch with those guys, but I don't know if anyone else has anything to add on that.
I would just add something that the work what Smart Africa does, it's truly admirable and to be applauded. And I think strengthening these inter-country and interstate relations within Africa and strengthening these technological cooperations within will make these partnerships stronger and will provide more negotiation power to all of you. I mean, there's a lot of GIZ programs that operate there. There's also the GovTech project that provides building blocks to come up with digital solutions. And I think that that support is needed, but that should be used to strengthen your power and to use it for more negotiation advantages.
Super briefly.
Yep. I have to say that, I mean, your concern is real and fully understood, but this is a wild world, let's say, problem. It's not only Africa. Mm-hmm. European citizens are also exposed to this, and all the West. Data, TikTok, for example, is one of these cases, but also all Facebook and instant messaging and Instagram and everybody, I mean, might say, might, you know, arise big question marks about how personal data are treated and stored and managed from this global cyberspace, I have to say. So in Somalia, just for giving you an example, with Conflict Navigator, I talked with the Minister of Interior, the Federal Minister of Interior. And we gave them all the infrastructure. I wrote the data governance, meaning all the servers, everything in the country, in the government. But I spent most of my time discussing how we are going to share this data with those that are interested, including beneficiaries, citizens of Somalia. This was the biggest and toughest challenge I have. I had to do artifacts and, you know, you cannot imagine to mention in the data governance and the sharing policy to retrieve this data from the government that wouldn't be happy to release this information. So it's also a matter of being there ready with the necessary policy rules, law enforcement and openness, the willing for sharing this data to the beneficiaries, in this case, citizens of Somalia.
Do we have time for another question?
We do. Yeah.
Do we have any more questions? This
can
gentleman?
I add two? Huh? Oh, yeah. Can I add two things also
no.
to that?
No. Yes, of course you can.
One, I think there's this allure of neutrality that a lot of these big tech companies really misuse. So we've seen that with Google saying, "Oh, I have no responsibility for the search results." And Safia Umoja Noble wrote a really great book on called Algorithms of Oppression, where I think thanks to her work, actually Google has changed their position, and as a result, everyone else, where rather than saying, "Oh, we're just a mirror to the world. If the world is racist, then we're also just mirroring that." And that was a very successful argument for decades until that book came out, where it proved when people were searching for... I can get into the specific example. I'll try to be short here. So now actually taking up that issue and also thinking about what that training data actually is doing and for specifically to AI. And I'm really glad you bring up the issue of labor, because in addition to that allure of neutrality, you also have the allure of, like, this is a super intelligent kind of black box machine, where actually the labor of tagging and classifying is being done in South Asian countries, in many countries in Africa, in Afghanistan, where people are going through all of these pretty traumatic it has to do with content moderation, but also with tagging and classifying. And that labor is really has a lot of malpractices. And people don't know what they are actually contributing to, which has created a really great movement. For example, we see with the Google workers against apartheid, who have been really active in making sure to hold their employers accountable. And the small thing also I'll add is that as the sharks remind us, as they bite on these undersea water cables that provide the internet, these are actually pretty fragile infrastructures, and if we want to maintain them, great. But there are also things to just also question this allure of neutrality, stability. These are things that are actually super fragile.
Really, really impactful. Do we have...
We do. Yeah.
Oh, Angela? Sorry, then we very briefly, if you want to ask your question, then you ask your question, and then that would be it. Yeah?
Can we have this gentleman that was the first one?
We have 10 minutes.
Raising the
we
hand
have 10 minutes, so please make
just
your questions
fair.
Brief.
No. You go, man.
Okay. Thank you so much. My name is Dr. Franklin from the Pan African Institute for Development in Cameroon. So I think I really want to appreciate all the panelists because I had so many questions, but each and everyone always come up with a point that responds immediately to my question. I would just want to encourage more of advocacy for a human-centric tech, which shouldn't be weaponized against, you know, certain regions, certain policies, and so on, to influence governments and so on, you know, and encourage more of localization of the tech. Localization of the tech so that it can serve as a leverage to bring a gap for peace restoration in crisis areas, whereby there are a lot of contradictions and actors are at far end. So a neutral tech coming in can actually just come to serve a purpose of peace restoration by using the people themselves, their creativity, like you have earlier said, to be able to resolve their own problems. My second point is also on the UNDP, maybe to reflect more on how humanitarian actors can be able to have or to have more trust for an open data on how the data can be used. Because, you know, in some areas where it's quite difficult to access for humanitarian intervention, where there are no networks, there are not even telephones, and workers have to go on the ground to collect data. So humanitarian organizations really have to invest a lot just to get that data. And due to a competition for funding, you know, they become very protective of their data so that they can be able to share it directly with donors and prove that they are doing well on the ground in order to have more funding, since there are so much constraint on that. That really makes it a serious challenge on the ground, where the use of data becomes quite protective instead of being shared across a platform that can help for effective intervention on the field. Thank you.
You want to start? I mean, I have a very, very quick point. So one thing that's it's very different to Africa, but with the German government and the Bertelsmann Stiftung, I designed this open source toolkit. Basically, it was a workshop that Landtags can download, which is like federal governments. And the idea of that toolkit was how can we get activists and third sector organizations to use their data? And the answers from that was incredibly localized. So you'd have from those workshops hyper-local narratives, how different data is used in different cultures, how it can be used for community resilience. And then the whole point of this was the evidence would go to the Landtag, and then the Landtag would send the evidence to the Bundestag, the central government, and then you'd have a super hyper-local narrative across the whole country, and you could see how different it all is. And that's really, from my point of view, the only thing you can do to empower people on the ground is to, again, to have those, make sure those voices of residents, of communities, of third sector, of the local government, are actually represented within a national scale? Because Cameroon is going to be very, one part of Cameroon is going to be very different to the other part of Cameroon, I assume, like anywhere in the world. And it's just important that those are, in a more official sense, that those kind of localized policy narratives and outreaches is documented. So that's my little point. You're going to obviously have a point, aren't you?
Yeah, very quickly. Yeah. Thanks. The question is very interesting. And this matter of trust, just give you a couple of examples. By default, when we start collecting data and managing data, by default, we have designed in our policy how this data will be shared at the end. I mentioned all the processes we go through, optimizing, minimizing, and making them anonymous and so on. The point is that we are a unit, global unit, and we need to localize to share this in a grander ways that people in these geographies can access the information. What we're doing, a couple of things. First, with Institute of Statistics, we are doing open days of data sharing information where we basically gather NGOs, researchers, universities, and all interested, and sits with us by presenting what available data we have for this specific geography. And Institute of Statistics is in the lead, trying to promote and make this a recurrent event over and over in the future. We cannot do it continuously. I mean, just this is the model. Second is having data newsroom, we call, with, again, local media, have these open days of and open discussions, along with the necessary training on data journalism, on not only sharing the data, but what are the avenues and the potential use of this data for media coverage and journalism purposes, how to publish them safely, how to defend, what are the methodologies, and so on. Again, we work with the Association of Journalists or NGOs that are behind the media, let's say, freedom and all this narrative around the data journalism. But these are, you know, initiatives that we are rolling out. Of course, we have to do a lot to cover globally, but entities like you, yours, let's say, or you are representing, definitely can be of help of thinking on those lines, on filling this gap that exists from this local big data storage and portals, and translating this in a very common, easy, accessible language to journalists, to governments, to researchers and other communities.
Okay, we have one more question, Angela.
Thank you very much. I want to come up, and I've really enjoyed the discussion, but I want to come up with one issue, because you've talked a lot about data, and you've talked a lot about access, and you've talked a lot about sharing of the data, but you have not talked about how the data is collected to the extent that, I'm sorry, but you know, my two African colleagues, that data comes from northern countries. That is not collected on the basis of Africa. And what we do know is that AI and technology in general is a driver of the economy, and that means if you don't have access to the data, or you don't have the data your own incorporated into the general collection of data, then you're missing out a lot. And that is something that really needs to be addressed. You have already mentioned the GDPR, and you've mentioned the EU AI Act, important, but there's also another process going on in the United Nations, and that's basically to develop AI, to have a paper. There's a 38-member body that has put together a zero draft. They are concluding, I think, this month, their final draft. But what I want to say to my African colleagues also is, your country is going to vote on that, and your country is going to basically make the push to sort of say, we have sustainable development goals, and we need to have not only access, but we also need to contribute to that data. And that's a decision point that's going to come up in the fall. And to my mind, that is extremely important to focus on that, that it isn't a northern initiative that is then shared and maybe applied to the south, but it really needs to be a much more active actor and have agency in that sense.
Completely agree. I don't want to be too negative, but if you look at the open data economy, the economy of data, it's pretty broken. And you can look at it, it's gender biased, it's racially biased. We don't have enough sources from different parts of the world. We're talking now all the time about how do we train AI? We train it on data. And if that data is intrinsically broken, we have a massive issue. Now, luckily we have the UN in the room. who could, you know, you could raise these thoughts and problems that we have. But, you know, when we're talking about civic tech, and how, like, these guys are really great at activating people and bringing them on board and, you know, and using tech for good, the same needs to be done for data. And we need to find data stewards. We need to find data stewards from different parts of the world. And we had a fantastic conversation before about, you know, in Senegal and the need and the want. And, you know, there's people out there. It's just we need to activate them. And again, it needs to be some sort of official mechanisms as well. It can't, I mean, I'm an activist. You know, I see myself as a social activist before a peace builder, before wherever. I'm an activist. And it's all well and good having people like me, but there needs to be that official buy-in. So from that activism to becoming actually that's something that's, you can feel and touch and actually make change instead of just talking about it. Because, and one more whinge and I'll stop. So in the UK very recently, we had the AI conference. All these people from around the world came. How can we make AI more ethical? How can we make it more human-centric? And you look around the room and you'd have Elon Musk, Facebook, Amazon, all there. And it's like this is the most protectionist and worrying thing in the world. It's happening, right? And, you know, there needs to be these kind of conversations and, you know, what you raise where to make it, to break kind of down those walls, because if that's not dealt with, we talk about this narrative problem, this is going to go a very, very nasty and horrible and way which won't be saved. And this is why, again, taking this activist mentality, but in an official sense, needs to be really bloody loud, because if it doesn't. But luckily, we've got people like you, Angela, who can make those noises. But sorry, I would pass on to my colleagues.
Maybe I just wanted to add the social license concept that I mentioned earlier. The social license concept is strictly focused on how data is collected, from which communities, and what agency is given to the communities to control the collection of their data. And when we're talking about data use, data collection is implied in it. And also, if we're talking only for data collection in separation, in isolation, we might also fall into these data collection silos of continuously collecting data on the ground that we don't really need to, and it's duplicated efforts, which is why data reuse is really important to be emphasized. One of the main roles of the reimagined role of a data steward is to reuse data that has already been collected for one purpose. Fabiola already mentioned this point, that can be reused for another purpose. And when you're reusing, what kind of agency do you give to the initial communities that the data was collected from? So I think, yeah, that was my addition.
Maybe one last thing that I would like to add is, for example, the Global Open Data Index that I mentioned before the project was discontinued, because at a certain moment we kind of like realized that maybe the criteria that we were using to collect the data were maybe not so fair and not so unbiased as we would have liked to think. So maybe that's something also that we need to think about. What, like, how are we collecting the data? What are the requirements and the criteria that we're using?
I'm afraid that's all we have time for. I hope you can, you know, find the speakers at the brunch and maybe ask one or two more questions if you have them informally. But please make your way to the courtyard, enjoy the closing, and we are excited to have you back in this room next year.